running is Pickett against Lindsay. Ms. Savantes.
Good morning. May it please the court. My client, Mr. Ozzie Pickett, is currently incarcerated in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections. He has been there for several years, and I was appointed to represent him after he filed a suit in federal court under Section 1983 alleging constitutional violations from various incidents that occurred while he was in Stateville during the 1997-98 time period. We proceeded through finishing discovery for him and tried the case in January 2001. Three claims were tried to the jury. One was a violation of his Eighth Amendment rights by virtue of alleged deliberate indifference by the correctional officers regarding the cell that he was put in when he first came to Stateville. The second claim related to four different incidents where excessive force was used in violation of his Eighth Amendment rights. And the third claim related to violation of due process. The jury found in favor of the defendants, and we proceeded to post-trial motions. We sought a new trial, and the district court denied a new trial. We seek reversal of that denial on grounds of abuse of discretion. Our principal and initial argument is that prejudicial error occurred by virtue of arguments made by the state's attorney during closing. In particular, a serious issue in this how I tried this case and how I imagine it's an issue that comes up in many of these cases is the fact that the prisoners, especially if they have been in IDOC, under IDOC for a long time, have very long disciplinary records. Records that for the most part were done under processes that have not been reviewed in a court, but instead are within their own prison's processes. In the pretrial conference stage, there were a number of exhibits by the state's attorney that they were seeking to introduce into evidence that basically brought forth Mr. Pickett's entire disciplinary history. The district court sustained our objections to this wholesale introduction on a couple key grounds, one being the lack of trustworthiness of the conclusions by the department regarding the discipline. The district court did not find persuasive the state's attorney's argument that all those were business records. She did not feel they had the trustworthy qualities of business records. Another reason was relevance, because the case was not supposed to be about Mr. Pickett's entire disciplinary history, but rather the case was supposed to be regarding the incidents of his claims. We then proceeded to trial, and as I said, the trial lasted about 4 days, and in the course of the trial, there were a couple other attempts by the state to bring in, on behalf of the individual correctional officers, evidence regarding Mr. Pickett's disciplinary record. The district court consistently denied all those attempts. At closing, when the state's attorney proceeded to make her argument, in part to support her claim that excessive force was not used, in part to paint a picture of Mr. Pickett that she found appropriate, she argued, "What do we know about this gentleman, Ozzie Pickett? Well, the testimony has shown this was a gentleman that was out of control when he was in Stateville in the segregation unit. He was a tremendous rule violator. I objected, and immediately my objection was sustained. I didn't even have to state much of a ground. And the state's attorney at that point suggested to the judge that this is just argument, and as the judge pointed out, it's argument, but it has to be something which is arguably supported by the evidence. As the fact that I objected and the objection was sustained, and if we look at what happened here, is the situation that Mr. Pickett clearly was put through the closing argument in a situation where they made plainly unwarranted arguments. There was no evidence in the record to support the argument that he was a tremendous rule violator, and the argument that they made was clearly injurious. Let's focus as to why it's clearly unwarranted. What was wrong with it is that he may have a disciplinary history, no one is denying. But we never tried this case as a way of suggesting whether he was any more of a problem or any less of a problem than other prisoners. And therefore, when they jump to the conclusion of that he's a tremendous rule violator, they have already concluded that their own records, that the court said that can't just be brought in wholesale, and their own conclusions, without putting it in any context, gives them the right to be arguing that this man was a particularly egregious problem. That is, to me, that's a classic example of we make it clear that that's not the path that we're going to try the case under. The judge rules specifically and says you're not going to be saying it is many steps beyond. Obviously, the prisoners have records. They're convicted. We're not in there saying they're not convicts. We put into evidence what he was convicted for. We don't deny that he's in segregation. But on the other hand, we should not be burdened by the fact that the department has made certain decisions about where they are in segregation, and then they get to expand on that and use it to inflame the jury. Because in all reality, even if we have the most open-minded jury in the world, we are trying a case that deals with someone that the system has already decided should be in prison for many years. And what makes it particularly a problem, as I found in this case, was the whole case related about the whole case turned on credibility. Mr. Pickett was raising claims for the most part that related to events where it was him and certain correctional officers. We didn't have witnesses. It was his word against the correctional officers. And what the reason that I believe in this case it was particularly egregious for the state's attorney to go down that path is, number one, they were told they shouldn't go down the path, and number two, they made an argument that was clearly calculated to show that...
Well, you're arguing to us as if we were the trial judge. But, of course, our review is deferential.
And I can appreciate...
What is it about the trial judge's decision that this comment in the context of the trial did not require a new trial that represents a clear error or an abuse of discretion?
The abuse of discretion, Your Honor, is found in the fact that the trial court concluded that it was clearly inappropriate for them to make that argument. And I think at that stage, the mere fact that she does not grant us a new trial is the abuse of discretion. Because
That can't. Right. Judges all the time upbraid counsel for doing things that they think are inappropriate, but they don't restart the trial every time that happens.
Fair, Your Honor, but in this case, this is a particularly key element, and where we believe the court abuses discretion is in underplaying the relevance of the fact that it does go to this man's credibility. And I think the point that we're trying to make to this court is, in certain ways, this is something that goes a little bit beyond just this case, although only this case is in front of the court. I appreciate that. But the circumstance that we're faced here is a circumstance that can arise in other cases. And we do believe it is important to set a more broad policy that says that certain rules have to be followed when you're trying these cases. And I think the district court should have recognized that the state's attorney was consciously making an argument that the district court repeatedly tried to keep state's attorney from bringing into evidence. And that by itself is something that requires reversal. They went beyond the realm. And here, the credibility issue plays also to the second reason that we felt it was appropriate to seek reversal of the trial court's decision, which was the exclusion of a particular piece of evidence. As I referenced the fact there were a number of exhibits regarding Mr. Pickett's disciplinary history, and none of these exhibits were going to go in wholesale to the jury. A lot of them had nothing to do with anything before the jury. One of the incidents upon which Mr. Pickett's claims were based related to the situation of where he was taken to the showers. He asked for a razor. He refused the razor. He stepped away when they tried to uncuff him to trigger bringing in a senior officer to hear his complaint. Instead, he was left there. He testified that the officer then came, brought him out, and beat him up. The officer says, no, I left him in the shower. When I came to take him out of the shower, I cuffed him, but as soon as I brought him out of the showers, he slipped out of his cuffs. That claim related both to his second claim about excessive force and his third claim about failure to give him due process. And he was given a disciplinary ticket for assaulting this officer. And there was an investigation, and there was a report by the department concluding that he had assaulted the officer. Part of the investigation included statements that were taken by the department's investigator of two inmates and another officer. One of the inmates' statements corroborated Mr. Pickett's version of the sequence of events. And in fact, Officer Hall, when he was cross-examined, admitted that if somebody had heard the sequence the way this inmate was saying it, it would be contradicting his own testimony. We had identified the entire set of disciplinary records in our exhibits, and the state attorney had not raised any objections during the pretrial order. When the trial was done, we sought to introduce the statements. We did not want to introduce the entire records, generally, since they were irrelevant, and we also did not want to introduce, as part of the statement, the conclusion of the department, which the conclusion was to disbelieve the inmate's statement. Accordingly, we asked that only the statement and all the other statements, and it's at page A17 of our appendix, we were seeking all three statements as taken by the department to be introduced into evidence. The department objected, the state's attorney objected on behalf of the officers, claiming that it was incomplete, and the court sustained that. We believe it was an abuse of discretion for the court to sustain that to begin with, and also it was an abuse of discretion when she did not, in looking at her post-trial motions, conclude that there was no basis for excluding that document. It was a document that was part of the pretrial. There had been no objection raised to it. It was to argue completeness or incompleteness was inappropriate because we were seeking to put in all three statements. And it was and it created an extremely prejudicial situation, in part because it came right at the end of the trial. Therefore, we had no opportunity to even attempt to bring in that testimony. Second of all, as I pointed out to the court, the inmate was actually in Shawnee, which was about 400 miles away, therefore not within my subpoena power. Those were the two principal errors that we believe justify a new trial. We also do believe that overall the evidence, as we argued in our briefs, did not support the verdict. So if I may, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wunder.
Good morning, Your Honors. Laura Wunder on behalf of the defendants appellees. I'd like to address why the district court correctly denied Mr. Pickett's motion for a new trial, but before I begin, I'd actually like to correct an error in the brief in which I misidentified an institution. I state that I referred to it as TAMS, and I should have referred to it as Stateville. That is on page 13 of the brief. There is a sentence just before the quote that says, while describing TAMS Correctional Facility, and then I say what counsel said in closing argument, who goes to TAMS, that should be Stateville on page 13. And that's again picked up on page 21, the second sentence from the bottom again refers to TAMS when it should be Stateville, and I apologize for that. Turning to what this appeal is about, the district court correctly denied Mr. Pickett's motion for a new trial. The plaintiff hasn't shown any type of defect that would warrant that very extraordinary remedy. And I'd like to look at Mr. Pickett's specific claims. And considering those claims, there are, of course, principles that guide this court's review. Of course, this court's review is guided by the standard of review, which, as the court just noted, was considerably deferential. The court has a lot of discretion in deciding whether to deny a new trial. And at least one occasion, this court has described its reviewing task as to determine whether a reasonable person could agree with the district court's decision. And here, the court certainly made careful and reasoned assessments. An additional principle that defines the court's review role is that the court's not simply looking for whether some type of error or imperfection occurred in a trial. Of course, what the court is looking for is a showing of something very substantial, a prejudicial error that affected the substantial rights of the parties, and that, of course, is a very high threshold. And finally, in this case, the state of the record is also important because while plaintiff's arguments should be rejected on their merits, there's a more fundamental problem, which is that the appellant has not supplied the entire trial record. The record supplied on appeal is inadequate. It's inadequate because there was a trial that lasted for several days, and what the plaintiff supplies is simply the plaintiff's testimony omitting the entire other side of the story, the defendant's testimony, the testimony of all the defendants who testified, as well as the testimony of a number of defense witnesses who testified. And we have a sense of what the defendants and the defense witnesses testified to, because the district court summarizes some of the testimony in the opinion, and there are references to the testimony in closing arguments. But to evaluate the arguments the plaintiff's making here, to consider granting a new trial, the court would, of course, need to see the entire trial record. That's certainly true for an against the manifest weight of the evidence argument, where the court would, of course, have to look at all the evidence to see what would be against the manifest weight of it.
Did you make arrangements to augment the record?
No, Your Honor. No form under 10B was filed by the appellant in this case, but the issue here is whether the appellant supplied a sufficient record in the first place. I'm not saying that there are things in the record that I would like to show you in arguing outside the record. I'm simply saying they haven't made out the claims they need to make. They haven't shown, just by what we see, the limited record we see, there's no reason to conclude that the verdict is against the manifest weight of the evidence. Just by the limited record we see, there's no demonstration of any sort of prejudicial error. So that ends the task before the court. But in order to seriously consider a new trial, the court would, of course, need to consider the context of the whole trial. And we don't even have that here. So to turn to counsel has called her principal argument. She takes issue with a statement in closing argument by defense counsel in which defense counsel referred to Mr. Pickett as a rule violator. And this court has frequently held that statements in closing argument rarely rise to the level of reversible error, and this is certainly no exception. The remark was not improper, and even if we go beyond that step and assume some impropriety, it certainly didn't rise to that level of prejudicial error.
How could it be proper?
The remark was proper because plaintiff's characterization of the remark is wrong. Plaintiff is suggesting here that what the remark did was to somehow play to the jury's bias by bringing in the plaintiff's disciplinary history, which had been excluded from evidence by the court. But that's not what the remark did at all. The remark wasn't trying the case based on the disciplinary history. The remark was saying that there's no reference to disciplinary history here. What the remark said was that Mr. Pickett was a rule violator, and there was evidence in the record that supported that. There was a lot of evidence in the record that supported that. And actually, the district court finds that as well. The district court says the fact that Mr. Pickett was a rule violator is supported by evidence. And some of the evidence in the record is Mr. Pickett's own acknowledgement that he violated the rules by interfering with Officer Lindsay when Officer Lindsay attempted to close the chuck hole door. He says, yes, that was a violation of the rules. Mr. Pickett received a disciplinary ticket for assaulting Officer Lindsay by throwing a food tray at him. That, of course, is in violation of the rules. There's evidence that Mr. Pickett refused to let himself have his handcuffs removed when he was taken to a strip cell. He was not cooperating with the officers. He was disobeying their orders, again, in violation of the rules. There was evidence that he began a fight with Officer Hall in the shower after a dispute. Again, that would be in violation of the rules. So there was a lot of evidence that Mr. Pickett violated rules by assaulting officers and provoking altercations with officers and disobeying direct orders of officers, and that was really what the point of the remark was. Based on this evidence, the use of force, the jury should conclude that the use of force is justified because the plaintiff is disobeying orders and refusing to cooperate with the officers. There was no discussion of, Mr. Pickett has 25 other disciplinary tickets at these other various institutions. There was no argument along those lines at all. In fact, when the district court expresses any concern at all about the remark, the district court says, well, defense counsel shouldn't have made the comment about plaintiff's long disciplinary history, but I've considered it, and I don't think that that warrants a new trial. Actually, the precise comment, long disciplinary history, is a paraphrase by plaintiff's counsel. This was made in the post-trial motion, probably before the transcripts actually came out, that is a mistake. There is no comment about long disciplinary history of the plaintiff. And to the extent the court had any concern at all, it was about that aspect of the remark, and that was not made. So the remark itself is properly based on the evidence. But again, that's not really what the court's looking at. The court is looking at whether there was some type of unfair prejudice here. And to do that, what the court does is evaluate the remark in the context of the entire closing argument and the jury instructions. And when we go through those steps here, there is nothing that warrants a new trial.
Does the review of the record show that remark as the only offensive one, the one that was objected to and that the judge sustained the objection?
It is the only one that was objected to. Counsel also raises an argument based on an additional remark which was not objected to at the time of trial. A remark.
One she refers to on here today, I forget what it was. It wasn't long disciplinary something or other. It was
that Mr. Pickett was out of control while a state civilian, a rule violator. That's her primary objection.
And the judge didn't.
The judge sustained that objection.
Right, but when the judge was talking about, or I guess summing it up, the judge referred to some other type of remark, a long rule. What was it? You said it was paraphrased.
In the judge's decision, it's sort of as part of the same remark. The way it was presented to the judge was as if defense counsel had said, Mr. Pickett has a long disciplinary history and he is a rule violator, and it was still one complaint by the plaintiff but the way the remark was described to include a reference to long disciplinary history is not actually what was said.
Okay.
The district court was under a mistaken impression about that, and it was the long disciplinary history reference that concerned the court mainly. So if we look at the factors that the court typically does to evaluate whether something prejudicial has occurred, we don't have that here because the remark was very brief. It was not emphasized at all. A sentence in 23 pages of argument. The argument as a whole was very focused on a specific incident and the specific evidence at trial. As I said, there was an objection which was sustained. Counsel immediately moved on to another subject matter. There were curative instructions given here. The court told the jury to disregard any comments that proceed to sustained objections, and the court told the jury to be aware that arguments of counsel are not evidence. There was also opportunity for rebuttal in this case, which plaintiff's counsel made use of. In her rebuttal, she was arguing to the jury, you should really consider the specific incidents in this case and not concern yourselves with Mr. Pickett's disciplinary record in prison.
I wonder if I could change focus for a moment with respect to the admission of the investigator summary.
Yes.
How do you get around this court's holding in the Emeco Cadiz case? If you recall, in that case, contrary to most circuit precedent, at least the case can be interpreted as saying that a single summary is in fact admissible from a business record.
The single summary is admissible as a business record? I'm actually not familiar with the case, Your Honor, but
it was a different kind of business record. It was a compilation of figures and things of that nature,
I'm thinking that it must be because
it didn't purport to overrule other cases in the circuit, but I just wondered if, from your perspective, if it had any validity here.
What's at issue here is a specific statement by an inmate, was taken down by an investigator, and so it falls squarely within
Your basic point being that by taking down the information, the investigator was not accepting its validity, or by incorporating the statement in his report, he was not accepting its validity.
Recording is not the same as manifesting an adoption of its belief, and that's why it's not an exception, that's why it's not hearsay. It is hearsay because it's a statement of an inmate who's not there to testify being offered for the truth of it. And the court had determined that the business records exception doesn't apply to these prison summaries. And the defendants, okay, we will live with that ruling. They're not admissible as business records. And the plaintiff has offered no alternative reason why then they are not hearsay.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Also, the idea that the defendants, plaintiff never says why they're not hearsay. She simply says, well, defendants shouldn't be allowed to object to this because they didn't object in the pretrial statement. The district court addressed that by saying, well, defendants agreeing in the pretrial statement was when this was a set of prison documents that related to everything about this incident and other incidents. They cannot be fairly held to have waived an objection when Mr. Pickett himself is now taking back his agreement and just wants to incorporate a part of the document. The additional arguments are addressed more specifically in the brief, and if the court has no other questions, I'll conclude. Thank you very much, and we ask that you affirm the district court's decision.
Anything further, Ms. Savanas?
With respect to the business record question, the court's initial ruling regarding business records was directed to the fact that the department was seeking to introduce not only their investigative reports but their actual conclusions as to whether there had been a violation of prison rules or not. Therefore, with this particular incident, if we look at the appendix, the court will find that there is the entire exhibit, and when you go through the entire exhibit, you see that page 8-18 shows the department's conclusions. Page 8-19 is simply a summary of what the different witnesses said to the investigator. We believe that the summary by itself does satisfy the business record exception because it is done by someone with authority. Obviously, the department gave the investigator authority to record certain events contemporaneously and the other criteria, but primarily that is our reasoning as to why the district court's final conclusion that was that this statement anyway, which is not something the district court said during the ruling, but subsequently on our post-trials, her conclusion that this is not a business record anyway did not really look at the particular document that we were trying to introduce, which that document itself does fall under the business record exception. The other point I wanted to address was the point I want to make regarding the prejudice that was the result of the statement by the state's attorney that Mr. Pickett was a tremendous rule violator and out of control. The prejudice and the error here is the fact that we never had the opportunity during the trial to put in context whether this man was any more out of control or any less out of control than any other prisoner, because it can't be that the department's correctional officers are allowed to use excessive force because every prisoner violates some disciplinary rule at one point or another. My point that I wish to leave the court with is that the case was not supposed to be tried and was not tried as one of trying to show whether this man is a problem or not a problem, but focusing on the particular incident. And so when we try a case which focuses on the particular incident, it is grossly unfair to face in closing argument the concept that this man is a tremendous rule violator. It leaves us in a position that we cannot adequately respond, and it does prejudice by inflaming the jury's perceptions. Unless the court has any other questions, I thank the court.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.